Hello, this is Jim Wallace, and you're listening to a special edition of The Soul of a Nation, a podcast about how our faith should shape our politics, and not the other way around. I'm thankful to connect with Robbie Jones, the CEO and founder of Public Religion Research Institute, for this conversation on the impact and the importance of polling and the new difficulties as a result of COVID-19, maybe difficulties and perhaps, Robbie, opportunities. So, Robbie Jones, welcome to the Soul of a Nation. We are so excited to have you.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So, Robbie, what kind of polling has PRRI done since COVID-19 began? And how has COVID-19 changed the trends you look for?
Well, you know, like everyone, kind of everything has changed, and there are some things that are still the same. So the pandemic has certainly changed, you know, the lens through which we're seeing everything and the kinds of things we track around religion, culture, and politics. But you know, we're seeing some things that are bucking some of those trends. You know, for example, we're seeing actually some cooperation around keeping churches closed. And we were polling, we found majorities of Republicans and Democrats, majorities across religious traditions that were, you know, concerned about reopening too early and keeping churches closed. On the other hand, I think some of that in more recent weeks has been eroding. So we had this kind of moment of consensus where people were really worried that into March and April. And I think as we moved into May, we've seen some of those partisan divides kind of come back out, racial divides come back out. And what we're really seeing in terms of big patterns is really Republicans taking their cues from the president and particularly from the White House in his administration being less worried and moving away from that consensus. And also really a racial divide between white and African-American and Latino Americans in particular, with whites much more likely to be moving toward reopening now, and people of color in the country being much more reticent, saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we think we're not quite there.
It's interesting. You mentioned churches closing and opening. A recent New York Times opinion piece explained that most churches are or have handled this crisis pretty well, that most churches are being very cautious about reopening. But I've had a lot of media call me and say, all these churches are not opening. Let's talk about that. Do you think the generalization that churches are resisting social distancing recommendations resembles the way we generally hear about the faith voter bloc, especially the evangelical voting bloc, that it's all sort of the bad stuff's happening all here? And when the media began to ask me about that, I said, well, most churches I know, even evangelical ones, are being cautious and careful as far as I can see. And though yesterday I talked to a lieutenant governor in the Midwest, and one of the principal pressures on them now to reopen is coming from a big evangelical megachurch. So that seems to be shifting and changing.
I think it's been changing in recent weeks, but you know, when states were under, and it's been changing as states are removing their stay-at-home orders, right? But when states were clearly had the stay-at-home orders, we found both, you know, in polling, you know, people who were members of congregations, very, very few, I'm talking single digits, who were saying they were going to attend religious services in person. And that was across the board. Again, Republican, Democrat, evangelical, mainline Catholic, you know, really, it was a pretty broad consensus that no, you know, this is not a smart thing for us to do right now.
We saw that too. We felt the same thing. You did it in polling scientifically. We did it anecdotally, what we're hearing and seeing from faith leaders and pastors. And yet the media was not recognizing that much at the time. Now, as you just said, some of the divisiveness may be coming back. So I'd love to discuss what you just raised about white evangelical support for Donald Trump. You did a In April, PPRI released polling that showed double-digit declines in support for Trump among white evangelicals, white Catholics, and white mainline Protestants. What do you attribute this to, and how is it impacting Trump's overall approval rating? And do you think this drop will hold or not through the election?
Well, so we did find some really, we've been polling on this about every month. We had polling throughout 2019. Actually, we've been tracking this since 2015. So we've had polling all the way back to 2015, and also every month this year. And so we've been able to see really as the pandemic has progressed and as Trump has shifted his responses, basically what we saw is that he reached a peak of support in March. Now, for Trump, peak support is actually just under 50%, 49%. But that was the highest favorability rating we had ever recorded for President Trump. Now, it's much, much higher. That's overall. It's much, much higher than that among white evangelical Protestants. But we saw this really remarkable drop across groups, really. You know, we double digits, as you said, among white evangelical Protestants, white Catholics, white mainline Protestants. Now, that still leaves his support very, very high among those groups because it started off. So, for example, even after double-digit support in April, white evangelical Protestant support is still two-thirds support, right? So it just went from, a little more than three-quarters down to two-thirds. But it has dropped to about half of white Catholics and under half of white mainline Protestants. And again, those are all double-digit drops. And what's happened is that basically March was the anomaly. And I think that was like the turn when President Trump, I think, finally came around to admitting that this was a serious issue, right? All through February, he'd been playing it down. And so March was really the first turn where he started having these briefings. But then I think by April, those briefings had turned, I think it's, fair to say, into very bumpy, rambling, things where Trump was using it to mostly air grievances as much as he was to, or even more than he was to give public health information. And I think that actually hurt him. And so I think we see that effect in April, that his performances, I think, on the daily basis during those things, I think hurt him even among, some of his strongest base groups.
Yeah, I've got your numbers here. I find them very interesting. Of course, the iconic 81% white evangelical support that was all over the media after the election in March, it was 77%, not far away from that. But then you had this down to 66%, which is a 10-point drop. And as you say, nearly half of white Catholics, but that went down from 60 to 48. Mm-hmm. And then to white Protestants, from 62 in March to 44%. So those are significant drops. So how do you interpret that from your polling?
Yeah. Well, if you put those into context, what they look like is they've basically dropped back down to 2019 levels. For the most part, March was the anomaly where it was really up well above levels that we've seen before. But in all the groups you've just mentioned, they're roughly within the range of where they were across 2019. So he's basically kind of gone back to his baseline. Now, if you're, thinking about this from the Trump campaign's point of view, what this looks like is really a squandered opportunity, right? That he had a kind of rally around the flag effect in March, where when he was first stepping onto the podium and kind of taking this seriously, and then not 4 weeks later, he's lost it, right? It's kind of back down. So I don't think this has really changed the fundamental game so much, at least as we're seeing it right now, as it represents, I think, a squandered opportunity by Trump mm-hmm. and the Trump campaign.
So you talk about the nation's obsession with white evangelical voting patterns. Has that waned amid our current crisis, or from the election to now, it's 81% to 66%? Do you think this is altering, shifting, changing in ways that will last to the election, or what do you predict just from your polling data?
You know, if it ever is hard to predict in a normal time, I mean, in this time, it is. Anybody who tells you they know what's going on, is not one who should be listened to. But I think that it will matter a lot what happens going forward. I think he had an opportunity. I think clearly lost that opportunity, and now I think the question is what's going to happen between now and the election, and we're looking at We could be surpassing 100,000 deaths very easily if the current trends continue, and that's that's actually where the predictions were at the beginning of April, and they got revised down to 60,000. Right, if you remember, right at the end of March and the beginning of April, they were revised down, and now we've crossed 85,000, and we're certainly headed toward 100. I think. Very shortly. So that's a really different scenario. We're nearly within a month, we've almost doubled from 60 to over 100. That's a very big shift. The stock market is another, big thing. And then the other huge, issue is the unemployment numbers, that just keep climbing and with no end in sight, and particularly with things like the Paycheck Protection Program, which has propped up many small businesses. I mean, that's an eight week Band-Aid, right, on those businesses, and that's it. And so if they've been floated for, the months of May and June or April and May, we may see another wave of unemployment on the other side of that. And we could be easily looking at, depression era levels of employment. So I think there's so many kind of scenarios out there that looks really grim. And I think, if those keep going, we don't have a huge turnaround. It's going to be very, very hard for, if you remember, the Trump's favorability, as long as we've been tracking it, typically is around 40, 41%, something like that. Right. And so that's not 50, it's not 51. So he's got to sort of reach beyond kind of his base favorability by at least 10 points, to get anywhere near a majority, popular vote, in the election. And that's work that's going to be an uphill slog. If, the stock market's in the toilet, the death toll's continuing to climb, particularly with reopenings happening without many of the benchmarks being met. There's just a lot of volatility here.
So one of the biggest pieces of our discussion to me is about race in America, how your polling has revealed so much. And a number of us have said how COVID has sort of laid bare so many things in this country that have always been true, but often have been denied or not acknowledged or even just accepted and not cared about. So what has PRI's, what has PRI's polling looked like in regards to the racial disparities revealed by this virus? And in April 22nd this year, you wrote for Sojourners comparing the racial violence following the 1919 influenza epidemic to the current moment and what's been ignited by the xenophobic actions of the president. And it says, we join you in, quote, flattening the curb of xenophobia. So how, what have you learned now even more since COVID-19, verifying so many of these things? And how can polling be a tool for inclusion today?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, say it straight up. I mean, I'm concerned, deeply concerned. It's kind of why I wrote the piece, flattening the curve of xenophobia. We've been all thinking a lot about and sacrificing a lot to flatten, the infection curve, staying at home, being safe, being distant from people we love. It's if we look back at history, if history has kind of one big lesson for us, it's that when there's a massive wave of suffering and death, a second wave of racism and xenophobia are typically not that far behind. And so doing some preemptive work, I think all of us thinking about those temptations to scapegoat, to point the finger, are going to be very, very strong, particularly in an election context. Already when we have the highest office in the land calling the virus, for example, a foreign virus, the Chinese virus, the Kung flu, all of these things have come from, the Wuhan virus have come from this administration. And then also simultaneously using the virus for a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric, closing down the border even more, ratcheting up deportations, even of children who are alone. We're seeing, you know, a lot of responses like that. And I think when we're seeing those kinds of xenophobic ideas being spread really from the highest office of the land, you know, there's real work to do to help, I think, decouple, you know, a virus from a kind of racial bias and racial prejudice here. And we've seen some of that already. We've seen some, the FBI is already tracking a surge of anti-Asian racism. We have some reports already of Asian Americans being targeted, you know, both in terms of stigma, but also even in terms of some violent actions. And so I wrote this piece really just trying to draw a line there and realize that we've got a history of this in the country. And, you know, there's multiple, you know, times in our history where kind of disease outbreaks have led to clampdowns or even violence against certain ethnic groups. And just to realize, like, that's a human temptation that we really need to be vigilant about stamping out on the front end before yet, you know, not to be too cute about it, before it in fact goes viral.
Well, you speak very eloquently about how this is so deeply rooted in our history and how the end of white America per se, demographically as the majority population, is just revealing so much of what's been there for a long time, and how COVID now has verified or revealed or exposed all of that is really the data shows we can't deny anymore the impact of race on all these things, because COVID-19 just shows it.
Yeah, I mean, we've had, you know, in many ways, we've had this public health data out there for a long time, right? That African-Americans can be expected to live, all things being equal, live shorter lives than whites, have more poor health outcomes. You know, all this, you know, but as you said, I think the right words again, laid bare, revealed, that COVID-19 has sort of made visible, I think, things that have often been invisible because they're really due to long-term structural injustices. And I think Americans with our highly individualistic lenses, and I should say highly individualistic theologies, we have a difficult time, I think, seeing these kinds of structural things. And I think one thing this disease has done is, again, reveal it, bring it to the surface. So just for example, you know, the latest data I was looking at from Johns Hopkins, while African Americans represent only about 13% of the populations in the states that we have that are even reporting COVID-19 fatalities by race, you know, they account for 34% of the deaths. And that even when you ask people, whites are only about half as likely as non-whites in public opinion surveys to say someone in their family has contracted the virus. And most of that is really due to things like more non-whites than whites hold blue-collar jobs that sometimes require a trade-off between employment and safety. They're less likely to live in single-family homes, more likely to live in places with shared elevators or tight stairwells, less likely to have access to a car, and more likely to have worse baseline health conditions, right? All of that is like long-term structural injustice. And the challenge also is that it's actually, I think, you can see the injustice there. And then the other thing that I think is a real challenge for us, and when I say us this time, I mean white people in America, as I am one, is I think this sense of privilege and the way that the structures of this country have been set up, it has left whites with a kind of sense of invulnerability, right, that has been built on really centuries of injustice in the country. And you can see that already, like, not only in the experiences here, but when you ask about, for example, where the U.S. stands in relation to the pandemic, you have nearly two-thirds of non-whites saying that the worst is yet to come, that they still think there may be another wave, that we're not at all have flattened the curve. But when you ask whites that, it's less than half of whites who believe the worst is yet to come. And as many whites as that believe, you know, it's all behind us. So we're really facing, I think, racially structured, even visions of where we are with the virus and what we should be doing. So we've got this kind of racial divide where whites who've been less affected by it and are less likely to see themselves as vulnerable generally are really ready to reopen. And we're seeing most of the protests you're seeing have been, you know, virtually all white crowds, you know, protesting the stay at home orders, and people of color in the country who are much more vulnerable and have much more experience with it saying, yeah, not so fast.
I've been reading this week about some of those people who are wanting to reopen so aggressively and often saying, but I don't know anybody who's got COVID. I don't know anybody who's gotten sick. And then on our faith table calls, we've had several African-American church leaders on these calls who during those calls over several weeks have lost their mother, lost their father, elderly people in places like Detroit. So disparities are so clear.
Just one quick point on that, Jim, is the patterns are beginning to shift, though. What it looks like is it, of course, did hit bigger urban areas that have higher proportions of people of color. So that first wave has hit African-Americans in particular harder than whites. But in the last weeks, we are seeing for the first time the number of new cases in high prevalence counties are actually for the first time in non-metropolitan areas in the South and the Midwest with a larger share of white residents. For example, if you look at the kind of end of March, whites were only less than half of the cases in high prevalence counties. But in the last week of data, that number is 65%. So whites are now making up 65% of the new cases. And there's a lag effect, right? We see the new cases and it takes 3 to 5 weeks before we see what the real results are in terms of deaths from those cases. And I think we are in this place where, this sense of whites kind of invulnerability and they're having not experienced these cases yet on a kind of a collision course with a rapid move to reopen, because we could be in for a very dark time in 3 to 5 weeks.
Well, we've seen reveal the unequal suffering of the pandemic so far, but as you're pointing out now, it may be that shared and common suffering could even bring us together. Suffering sometimes does that. So that's maybe a theological or spiritual question going forward.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this too, that, you know, I think that white Americans have been accustomed to, you know, having a sense of protection because the structures of society are really set up to insulate, you know, whites from economic downturns, political fallout, physical danger, all of that stuff. But, you know, I think that, you know, we're facing a virus that is pretty oblivious to those expectations of safety from white America. And I think that may come as a real shock to the system that we may see. And it may, in fact, lead to, some reevaluation and some greater sense of solidarity in the wake of that.
You put so much of this in that historical context, showing how a pollster like you, it's really both a science and an art, and it sometimes can reveal things about us that we need to face and even help us to see what kind of future that we'd like to have or who's going to be the we in this future going forward. So thank you, Robbie.
Thanks, Jim.
For news, resources, and reflections about our current public health crisis, visit sojo.net/coronavirus. If you enjoy this podcast, please share this episode with your friends and family and even your enemies, as Jesus calls us to love them too. And what better way to love someone than to share a conversation just like this? We're available on iTunes, Google Play, or whatever you listen to for your podcast. After you listen, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And follow me on Twitter if you'd like at Jim Wallace. This is Jim Wallace for the Soul of the Nation. God bless you.